Hello, and welcome to this month's podcast covering the discussions on the amendments to IFRS 17. My name is Andrea Pride. I'm on the technical staff of the ISB, and today I'm with Daryl Scott, who is one of the board advisors most interested in IFRS 17. So the papers for this meeting covered a large number of topics. They were papers A to H, so eight papers plus a cover note. But one of the most important topics to be discussed today was the level of aggregation. Together with the board meetings over the last few months, the meeting today covered each of the 25 topics that were identified to the board at its October meeting. And this means that while it's possible that further implementation issues could arise and could be identified to us, we so far expect that any of those further issues are unlikely to lead to further standard setting at this stage. And that's really because it's now been 22 months since IFRS 17 was issued, and we expect that substantive issues should have already been identified as companies started their implementation projects. So further changes to IFRS 17 could disrupt rather than help the implementation process. I mentioned that there were eight papers for this meeting. There's three of those topics I'd like to pick up in today's podcast. The first was the level of aggregation, which of course has been the subject of extensive debate by the board and with its stakeholders. Daryl, would you like to tell us a little bit about today's meeting?
Sure. So in the discussion today, we discussed three different papers that were brought to us by the staff. The first paper was a decision-making paper. The other two papers gave some background for us to think about as we walked through the process, in particular about how we had reached the decisions we had and why we had reached those decisions. Staff provided us with a couple of examples, one particularly good example that was drawn from an example that had been submitted to us by one of our constituents, and it allowed us to work through some of the very specific details and think through some of the specific details of what occurred under a grouped type of scenario. I think just to recap on what IFRS 17 requires, right now 17, as distinct from many other IFRS standards, specifically allows entities to aggregate contracts and measure them at a group level, but at the same time nonetheless limits the extent to which contracts can be grouped. And the board thought in developing this guidance that what we were doing was we were balancing on one side the nature of insurance, which is about grouping risks together, but on the other side the fact that the more grouping you had, the more you lost information about the development of individual trends about underwriting and profitability. Clearly, though, this grouping issue also plays into practicality, and I think that's why we've heard a lot of issues being raised from the preparer side, or concerns being raised by the preparer side around the grouping discussion. The board had quite an extensive discussion around what we had been hearing over the last number of months, and I think it was important to note that we've heard some really positive messages from user groups who are looking at IFRS 17 and specifically focusing on the information they get around onerous contracts, the information they get about trends in profitability over time, trends in underwriting over time, and about the resilience of different groups of contracts. I think we also talked a little bit about the concept of mutualization and specifically how mutualization arises in insurance examples, and specifically about the types of contracts that the ISB and IFRS 17 believes benefit from mutualization. And those are the contracts where the actual economics or the actual contractual terms of the contracts allow for a transfer from one particular group of policyholders to another group of policyholders. So considering where the standard had landed, considering the very positive messages that we had heard from users of IFRS 17, from the investors in the insurance industry, about the benefits of this grouping, we felt very strongly from a board perspective that there were significant benefits. And in fact, this type of grouping and the restriction on this type of grouping is one of the key benefits of IFRS 17. On the other hand, we acknowledge that clearly there are significant expenses involved, and we expected there to be significant expenses involved in this when we embarked on the process. And we accept that the industry is going through the process of incurring those expenses. But on balance, the board felt that the benefits exceed the costs, and consequently we reaffirmed what is in the existing IFRS 17.
Okay, thank you. So I think that was a very interesting discussion, and it was clear that lots of board members had thought about balancing that cost and that benefit. Looking at another group of stakeholders this time, another topic we discussed today was credit cards that meet the definition of an insurance contract because they provide insurance coverage. And the board there decided to provide a scope exception for these credit cards. So Daryl, could you tell us a little bit about the reasoning that went into that?
Sure. So the background started with the discussion of right now, many of these credit card type transactions are accounted for as a single contract under IFRS 9 or to a certain extent under IFRS 15. We noted that IFRS 9 provides good, consistent accounting for these contracts, that is, consistent with how other similar transactions have been accounted for in, for example, the books of banks, and that many banking entities and others have gone through a significant implementation process around IFRS 9 on these types of transactions. So they've already established an accounting process for them. And given that they've just completed their transition, and given that we believe that IFRS 9 is providing effective accounting, we think that there is some justification to the view that these transactions should be accounted for in their entirety under IFRS 9. I think it is important that we did stipulate in thinking about this one restriction in terms of which contracts apply. So these are credit card transactions which have an insurance element, but it is an insurance element that has not been separately priced for. So it hasn't actually been underwritten. The same price is offered to every single customer. And we think that's important because we think as soon as you move beyond that point, you are moving into actively providing an insurance product.
And the other set of papers that we discussed today were dealing with the sort of consequential and follow-up issues, and we had an overview of the transition and disclosure requirements that might be needed as a result of the decisions that the board had tentatively agreed. And there were two transition issues in particular that discussed, one about the loans that we had scope exception for last month, but perhaps more interestingly at this stage is the transition for the risk mitigation option, which was a follow-up for the discussion last month.
So last month when we discussed this, we discussed whether or not we would allow retrospective accounting for the risk mitigation relationship that exists. The board rejected that and decided to stick with what was in the existing IFRS 17. And we did that on the basis that we had a concern about the ability it would create for entities to cherry pick the relationships they specifically wanted to account for. And we felt that that would allow, firstly, the use of significant hindsight, but equally it would allow them to tailor the outcome that they wanted based on the starting position that they were looking for. At the same time as deciding that we were uncomfortable with following that approach because of the risk of hindsight, the board was equally uncomfortable with the view that we would end up in a situation where the underlying insurance contract was accounted for retrospectively, but the relationship, the risk mitigation relationship, was only accounted for prospectively. And we felt that that inconsistency may give rise in some circumstances to economic mismatches. So we asked the staff to bring us back further considerations that they might have if they once they'd had the opportunity to think through that process. And what the staff brought us, the paper the staff brought us this month was the recommendation that what we do is not touch the risk mitigation relationship because we believe that, as I say, that would bring in cherry picking, but instead look to the other side of the relationship, the insurance contract, and to allow the fair value approach for those insurance contracts. What they would provide us with in that opportunity was a consistent approach for the underlying contract and the relationship, because both of them would then be measured on a prospective basis. That said, the staff also recommended that, and the board agreed, that we limit the ability to apply this, and specifically we would be limiting the ability to apply this to the circumstance in which the entity had elected to apply risk mitigation accounting going forward from that point in time.
Okay, so we'll continue the process of evaluating all the proposals for disclosure and transition requirements that might be needed. But I think, like I said at the beginning of this podcast, we now believe that we are substantively concluded the deliberations for an exposure draft. And so while we may have further technical topics still to discuss, our expectation is that at the April meeting, we'll be asking the board to consider an overview of all the proposed amendments in the exposure draft and assess those amendments against the criteria that the board had back in October about not reducing the usefulness of information unacceptably and not unduly disrupting implementation. We also plan to be asking the board for permission to begin the balloting process for an exposure draft in April, and we'll be seeking permission from our due process oversight committee for a shorter comment period than the standard 120 days, reflecting both the focused nature of the proposed amendments and the urgency of finalising any amendments in time for entities to apply any revised standard for annual periods beginning on or after the 1st of January 2022. So I think this was a very significant month for us. We'll have more to come, so you're not losing your podcasts and your board discussions just yet. But that is all for this month. Thank you for listening.